the other Muslim brothers and sisters, and of course to help humanity on the whole. Now, of course, this assistance and this reliance then is something that is integral in Islam. But we must remember that the end all means and the true source of all of these things, and the only way to be able to achieve success, prosperity, and victory, of course, is in the hands of the Almighty Allah. And so we must never pin our absolute hope, and we must never pin our absolute reliance and our needs with somebody other than the Almighty Allah. First and foremost, we must know that the original cause, the only cause, the primary cause, and the pure source of all of our aspirations and hopes and needs is the Almighty Allah. Exalted and mighty is He. Now, once we have this in mind, then of course we can go and seek help from other people when we need it. This idea that we are not independent, and rather understanding this idea that we are dependent upon the Almighty Allah. And so along these lines in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to his companion that whoever hopes in a dissolute, the least of their punishment is that they will be deprived of that said blessing, and of course their needs will not be satisfied. And so of course a human being must not have this ultimate hope in anyone except the Creator and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Almighty, the Wise, the Knowledgeable, the Most Powerful. Now, there are two ways, at least, to interpret this second part, which is that an individual will be deprived of the blessings and their needs will not be satisfied. Now, one interpretation is that Allah Himself will deprive that individual of blessings, and Allah Himself will not satisfy the needs and the requests of the individual. Of course, because that individual has not asked Allah for the blessings and they have not asked Allah to fulfill their needs, so technically, why would Allah want to do so? But another interpretation is that, well, you will be deprived of the blessings because you are asking one who does not have the power to give you those blessings. And on the other hand, your needs will not be satisfied, your needs and requests will not be fulfilled, of course, because you are asking one who, again, does not have the power to satisfy those needs, does not have the power to fulfill those needs and those requests. And so thus you are in this manner also deprived of blessings, and you are also not able to fulfill the needs and desires that you had been requesting. But of course, in our daily lives, if we rely on the Almighty Allah, if we rely on the most merciful, the most compassionate Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then not only will Allah endow us with the blessings that are appropriate, but He will also fulfill those needs and requests, again, that are appropriate for every single one of us. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarat Text of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka أيها النور الساطع السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالع السلام
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the Righteous, the Pious, the Faithful Leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major dispute with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families too have suffered as a result. They too have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Quranic verses and anti-Israeli and U.S. slogans rank high in this year's National Day of Resilience demonstration in the capital Sana'a, where protesters celebrated what they called 9 years of successful resistance against the Saudi-led war, which began back in March 26, 2015. Yemen's Supreme Political Council leader, Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, who was present at the demonstration, said the armed resistance against all enemies of Yemen will continue until every inch of Yemeni land is liberated from foreign presence.
We must protect our resistance effort and continue to counter this enemy. We must march forward together and confront this enemy. We must focus more on the battlefront and prepare for it now more than ever before. We must support our Ministry of Defense, which is equipped with men who have the hearts of lions, men who will teach the enemy a lesson they will never forget.
When Saudi Arabia launched its war back in 2015, it said it would destroy all heavy weapons possessed by Ansar Allah and force them to withdraw from the Yemeni capital. What has happened, however, is quite the opposite. The Ansar Allah movement has managed to win the battle across the board, developing sophisticated weapons and taking over more territory. They've also managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the people in the north.
We have been at war for 9 years, and we will continue to go to war for another 90 years if we must. We will never surrender, no matter how much they bomb. Our faith is in Allah, and it will never be shaken.
We came out in this huge protest to send a message to the Saudi-led coalition that we will remain resilient and we will never betray our cause, even if they add another 9 years to the previous 9 years of war. With our military of believers in Allah, we are coming for you. We are coming with our ballistic missile.
According to Mohammed Ali al-Houthi, if the Saudi-led coalition continues its war on Yemen, they will only witness greater losses and a bigger humiliation.
The war that was only supposed to last a few weeks has entered its ninth year. What's even more surprising is that the Yemeni army is stronger now than ever before. That's because they have developed long-range ballistic missiles and drones, which could be used if the war continues. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
A sentiment echoed by other anti-apartheid campaigners here. Among them, the International Center of Justice for Palestinians, who have called on the British government to refer Israel and Netanyahu to the International Court of Justice for War Crimes in Palestine.
The protesters here are saying that the UK government's welcoming of Netanyahu is a mark of approval of his right-wing government, that it provides the Israeli regime with further cover to steal more Palestinian territory and to continue with its campaign of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people.
Earlier this week, the UK and Israel signed a so-called 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel relations, strengthening bilateral ties with the regime whose finance minister denies the existence of a Palestinian people.
This is an extreme right-wing government itself. So this is, you know, one proto-fascist government supporting a proper fascist government. So I don't feel that this government is ever representing me on other issues as well. But that they are supporting such an excessive, extreme right-wing government in Israel is a shame for all of us.
But while all eyes are on the intensified Israeli violence against Palestinians, others are highlighting another important reason that's dragged an embattled Netanyahu to Europe. His trip comes in the wake of the recent Chinese-brokered rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Netanyahu could be here to gauge European government's position on Iran. From London, the Israeli PM will be flying to Berlin, Germany, where he is expected to be greeted with similar protests. Saeed Pourreza, London. A day after a surprise jump in inflation, an expected rise in the Bank of England's interest rate from 4% to 4.25, the 11th increase in less than 2 years.
The Bank of England argues the increase in the interest rate is aimed at reducing inflation that's amongst the highest levels since 1982. On the other hand, there are some economists who are saying it'll inevitably increase the pressure on many Britons, already being squeezed by the cost of living crisis.
That's because a higher interest rate means a higher cost of borrowing.
It's going to affect people with mortgages, and it's going to affect companies with debt, and there's a lot of companies with a lot of debt.
Today's interest hike comes against the backdrop of this pledge by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in January.
We will halve inflation this year to ease the cost of living and give people financial security.
That is yet to happen. Some economists say some of the inflation rise can be blamed on potentially one-off factors, such as vegetable shortages caused by extreme weather in Spain and North Africa, and British producers not producing for fear of massive energy bills. Others say there are other underlying reasons. The Bank of England was the first to increase interest rates, but not the only one. EU and US central banks have also raised borrowing costs, with the American Central Bank's chair, Jerome Powell, saying there was still a long way to go to tame inflation in the world's largest economy. While Britons continue to contend with the soaring cost of food and energy, would this be the last rate hike by the UK's central bank? Syed Purizam, London.
Turkey's pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party and its allies have announced that they will not field a candidate to run against President Erdogan on May 14. HDP co-chairwoman Pervin Buldan made the announcement in a presser for the Labour and Freedom Alliance, which includes the HDP, the Turkish Workers' Party and other leftist parties. Although it was not made clear during the conference, the announcement means the HDP will support the opposition National Alliance candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
We will fulfill our historical responsibility against the one-man rule. We are determined to hold this government, which continues a rule based on poverty and corruption. The HDP and its allies will not nominate a candidate for May 14.
The announcement is considered a major setback for Turkish President Erdogan, as the HDP is the third largest party in parliament. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan slammed the opposition bloc's cooperation with the pro-PKK People's Democratic Party, saying alliances should focus on common principles rather than negotiations over seats.
The announcement by the Kurdish alliance that they will not nominate a candidate will make this election difficult for President Erdogan, which means that the Kurdish votes will go to Kılıçdaroğlu. Yesterday, we also heard President Erdogan say that 17 of his ministers and his deputy will run for parliamentary elections to strengthen his party's position in these elections. Erdogan knows his position is not the strongest after the Kurdish alliance announcement and is trying to fix things around him to make sure he wins.
On Tuesday, the day before the announcement, Kılıçdaroğlu met with HDP leadership in the parliament building in Ankara, during which he made promises to remove restrictions on the Kurdish language and address other related issues. The May 14 election looks to be a tough one for the ruling party and its allies. Many say Kurdish voters could play the role of a kingmaker and help the opposition win this time. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 Convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has, in turn, led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalazavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France, but unfortunately the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Destination following his re-election.
This is in line with historical logic because we are each other's largest neighboring powers. We are also all-round strategic partners.
This is the 40th meeting between Putin and Xi during their presidency, which indicates the high and close level of cooperation between China and Russia for a long time. President Xi arrived in Moscow in March 24, three-day visit. He began his visit with an informal meeting with Vladimir Putin, which lasted almost 5 hours. On Tuesday, the head of state held an official meeting at the Grand Kremlin Palace. The priority in relations between Russia and China is trade and economic cooperation. In the documents signed by the two leaders, they vowed to multiply the volume of trade. It is expected that the Russian Federation and China will exceed the historical record trade volume of $200 billion this year. On February 24th, on the anniversary of the start of the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Chinese Foreign Ministry presented a 12-point plan to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
We believe that many of the provisions of the peace plan put forward by China are consonant with Russian approaches and can be taken as the basis for a peaceful settlement when they are ready for it in the West and in Kiev. However, so far we have not observed such readiness on their part.
China and Russia, as permanent members of the UN Security Council, also vowed to uphold the fundamental norms of international relations and build up constructive force for the formation of a multipolar world.
As for sending military equipment and weapons, military cooperation, China is unlikely to take drastic steps. First of all, China acts based on its own interests, not forgetting that relations with the Western world do not become bad. Otherwise, China itself faces sanctions. Its main trading partners are still in the West.
Putin and Xi Jinping also signed two joint documents setting long-term goals until 2030 across all tracks, a statement on plans for economic cooperation and a statement on plans to deepen partnership.
The Chinese president's three-day visit to Russia demonstrates the close historical relations between Beijing and Moscow. Any agreement made during Xi's trip can be regarded as a milestone given the fact that a new world order is being shaped. Marina Kartonova, Moscow.
Black community leaders demanding immediate action to reform Britain's largest police force, coinciding with an official report into the Metropolitan Police by victims' rights and social welfare expert. It was exactly that failure that prompted the report. In March 2021, Wayne Cousins, a serving Metropolitan Police officer, abducted, tortured, raped, and killed Sarah Everard. cousins, was jailed for life. His conviction prompted another woman to come forward, accusing another officer, David Carrick, convicted of raping 12 victims over 17 years. Police Commissioner Mark Rowley has welcomed the report, but stopped short of admitting the force he leads is institutionally racist.
We have racist, misogynist and homophobes in the organisation, and it's not just about individuals. We have systemic failings, management failings and cultural failings. The reason, and I respect Louise using that term, the reason I don't use it, I think it's a very ambiguous term.
On the whole, the report is condemning of this big organization, pointing to the fact that it has lost public confidence and consent, and that it has to wake up, own up to the problems plaguing it, and engage in wholesale across-the-board reforms.
Black community leaders, though, say they're concerned the reform may not go far enough.
This is just another report saying the same thing that's been said for decades now in this here country. The Metropolitan Police is institutionally racist, policing is harmful, it's misogynistic, it is homophobic. And for me as a black woman, the police, the Met Police, is an anti-black organization, anti-black racism organization.
In February, the charity inquest found that black people are seven times more likely than white people.
Black people are five times more likely to be tasered than white people. You could go on and on and on.
The report is a wake-up call for the Metropolitan Police. Its author, as do these minority community leaders, says her recommendations are not to be picked from, but to be implemented. Without them, she says, the force may need to be disbanded. Saipur is up, London.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinda ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. Stay tuned. The best type of fasting in the month of Ramadan is the one in which the person who fasts separates his heart and soul from mundane world and only thinks about Allah and love for Him. Since the holy month of Ramadan is considered as the banquet of Allah, we are entering the safe realm of Allah. Therefore, we must only let the love of Allah inside our heart in this holy month.
چون قلب ها نوعاً روزه نیست نگه داشتن چشم.
Usually, we are fasting in the month of Ramadan without having our heart fasting. Our eyes must be fasting in this month too. In this month, we must take more care of our eyes and do not look at undesirable things. There must be a divine lesson in each look of us at the world. In this month, we must forget about illegitimate looks and also unnecessary looks around us. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Hashemi Nejad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.ir Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Serbian health minister has warned that NATO carried out inhumane experiment in the Balkans. The US-led military bloc bombed Serbia with toxic depleted uranium, which Britain now wants to give to Ukraine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT noted NATO's use of depleted uranium munitions in its air war against Yugoslavia was a horrible and inhumane experiment against the entire region. Serbian Health Minister Danica Guru Jikik has said contamination from these munitions led to a surge in cancer, autoimmune disease, and infertility, he added. NATO used 10 metric tons of depleted uranium, which is used to make the hardened cores of armor-piercing projectiles during its 1999 air campaign against Yugoslavia, the bloc admitted in a report a year afterwards. Although the report stated that depleted uranium poses practically no danger when ingested or absorbed through wounds, evidence from Serbia suggests otherwise. Radiation exists at that moment when the explosion occurs, and after that, the nanoparticles do the work, he told Serbia's RTS television network recently. These particles enter your lungs, digestive tract, kidneys, and then you can expect at any moment that one alpha particle, which is 50 times more carcinogenic than any other, will come out of one atom of depleted uranium in your body and turn a normal cell into a malignant one. Serbian health minister said that Serbian physicians began noticing a surge in leukemia and lymphoma cases 7 years after the bombing campaign and have since recorded increases in oncological diseases, pathological pregnancies, autoimmune diseases, mental disorders in children, and infertility in men. The Serbian health minister said it was an ugly and inhuman experiment on the entire region, not only Serbia and Montenegro. I hope that the international scientific community will understand that it should be investigated in a scientific way and that weapons with depleted uranium will be banned. The Serbian minister has long called for an international inquiry into NATO's use of depleted uranium. The former neurosurgeon told local media in 2016, pointing out that 5,500 out of every 100,000 Serbs suffer from some kind of carcinoma, a rate nearly three times the global average. It is essential that the citizens of Serbia know how much and what kind of damage they suffered. The UK earlier announced that it plans to supply Ukraine with depleted uranium shells for use with British-provided Challenger 2 battle tanks. The Russian Defense Ministry warned that these shells would cause irreparable harm to soldiers and civilians alike. According to Al Jazeera English, the British government has announced it will provide Ukraine with armor-piercing rounds containing depleted uranium, a byproduct of the uranium enrichment process needed to create nuclear weapons. The rounds retain some radioactive properties, but they cannot generate a nuclear reaction like a nuclear weapon would. Erward Jaist, a nuclear expert at research organization RAND, says, but the ammunition does carry risk, even if it is not a nuclear weapon. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of the process to create the rarer enriched uranium used in nuclear fuel and weapons. Although far less powerful than enriched uranium and incapable of generating a nuclear reaction, depleted uranium is extremely dense, more dense than lead, a quality that makes it highly attractive as a projectile. Jade said, it's so dense and it's got so much momentum that it just keeps going through the armor and it heats it up so much that it catches on fire. RAND senior defense analyst Scott Boston said, when fired, a depleted uranium munition becomes essentially an exotic metal dart fired at an extraordinarily high speed. In 1970s, the U.S. Army began making armor-piercing rounds with depleted uranium and has since added it to composite tank armor to strengthen it. It has also added depleted uranium to the munitions fired by the Air Force A-10 close air support attack plane known as the Tank Killer. The British have lost their bearings, said Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, warning the munitions are a step toward accelerating escalation. Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu said the announcement was another step and there isn't so many of them left. The United Nations Environment Program has described such ammunition as chemically and radiologically toxic heavy metal. While depleted uranium munitions are not considered nuclear weapons, their emission of low levels of radiation has led the UN nuclear watchdog to urge caution when handling and warn of the possible dangers of exposure. The handling of such ammunition should be kept to a minimum and protective apparel should be worn. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, cautions, adding a public information campaign may therefore be required to ensure that people avoid handling the projectiles. This should form part of any risk assessment, and such precautions should depend on the scope and number of ammunitions used in an area. The IAEA notes that depleted uranium is mainly a toxic chemical as opposed to a radiation hazard. Particles in aerosols can be inhaled or ingested, and while most would be exerted again, some can enter the bloodstream and cause kidney damage. The IAEA says high concentrations in the kidney can cause damage and, in extreme cases, renal failure.
Decides to, you know, migrate and to go in a place that there is no one but him to, you know, be helpful for the muhibbin of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wasalam. This is really important.
When we refer to his biography, we see one of his great achievement is establishment of the open school in the West.
Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say?
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Ya Mu'allim, peace be upon you, truly you are our teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, and I'm Atta, the host of this program. The Teacher is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, ulama, and jurists all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about a personality, a Shiite one, who has spent most of his life in the U.S., you know, and continuing his Islamic studies and training the students, the Muslim Shia ones, over there. He is no one but Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Husseini Jalali, also the founder of the Open School in Chicago. Really, a fruitful life he had over there, and is considered among the most outstanding bibliographer and codicologist of the 14th century Hijra all across the world of Islam. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the life of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, he was born in 1362 lunar calendar in Karbala, and he started his house studying in his childhood
and actually he benefited from the outstanding maraji of his time, Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim, Sayyid Abul Ghassim al-Khoi, Mirza Hassan Bujnuri. And he was really talented in his studying to the extent that he was able to get permission of riwaya, which is actually known of ijazah-e riwayat.
That's right.
This is not the position to be given easily to the students mm-hmm. of the ulama.
Yes.
When they reach to a level mm-hmm. of their scholarly life, they are given this position or this permission.
This ijazah is different from ijazah of ijtihad, you mean?
Yes, definitely.
This is, it means they have the understanding or the power of recognition of which ahadith are authentic and which are not. This is the ijazah of riwayah, or what is it?
Yes, this is exactly what you said with more information, but I think if we mention one of the great ulama who gave him the permission of ijazah, it may create a clear picture for our audiences
yes.
and our listeners. What do we mean by ijazah riwayah? Among the ulama from which he got the permission of riwayah is Agha Buzurg Tehrani.
Mm-hmm.
Agha Buzurg Tehrani, he himself is considered as one of the great ulama who is really expert in terms of codicology
yes.
and bibliography.
That's right.
Al-Dari'a fi Tasanif al-Shi'a yes. is yes. his work. That is yeah. a perfect work.
Yeah.
In terms of compiling the works of Shia.
That's right, the magnum opus of Sheikh Al-Bazir.
Yes, definitely. So he actually got permission of ijazah-e riwayah from Agha Buzurg Tehrani.
That's right.
In a sense that he was really familiar with the context of the riwayat
That's
to
right.
distinguish between
okay.
the authenticated riwayat,
yes.
fabricated riwayat, the narrators,
That's
chain
right.
of the narrators,
okay.
books
yes.
in which riwayat are compiled,
yes.
and things in relation to the riwaya and
good.
Ahadith.
So he had mastery over the important references and resources of Islam, and especially the Shia.
And
Islam.
Definitely manuscripts.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
That's right, the manuscripts. That's
yes.
all right. Very good. Thank you very much for these introductory remarks. So what made him move to the U.S., I mean the Chicago brother, Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali Sheikh Zainiyah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, when he completed his studies in Najaf, you know, there was an invitation from the Shia people in Chicago,
yes.
in United States of America, and they invited him to go there and to be a resident scholar over there, to preach Islam and to, you know, introduce Islam, the correct version of Islam to them.
That's right.
So he accepted this invitation and he was, you know, committed to this, you know, acceptance up to the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
And he was buried over there also.
Yes, that's right. In the Shiite cemetery of Chicago, he's buried
yes.
over there. That's right.
So it's very important that a person that is, you know, mujtahid
yes.
and is completely, you know, a knowledgeable person,
yes.
and he has a good future
mm-hmm.
in Najaf.
Yes.
If he stays in Najaf or if he stays in Qom, he will be a prominent scholar.
Scholar
he will
right.
be a prominent teacher,
yes.
and there will be a good future for him in this, you know, scholarly world of
that's
Qom
right.
or Najaf.
That's right.
But he decides to, you know, migrate,
yes.
and to go in a place that there is no one but him.
That's right.
To, you know, be helpful for the Shia of
right.
Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam and for the followers and,
yes.
you know, muhibbin of Ahlul Bayt
yes.
alayhi salatu wasalam. This is really important.
This is really important. And, you know, the interesting point is that the people stay over there, I mean, the Americans or the people in the Western countries stay in their own lands, and then the true preaching, you know, I mean, of Islam and propagation all across the world could be manifested in the activities of people like Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali. I think this is very much difficult, I mean, more difficult than staying in your homeland,
for
which
sure.
is a Muslim land, you know, and preach Islam.
For sure. You know, for a scholar, living in Qom or Najaf is much easier
yes.
than living, for example, in a city like Chicago.
Chicago, that's
because
right.
Because here, if you have your students,
yes.
you have your, you know, relationship with the people that are familiar with your manner.
Yes.
But when you go somewhere that people are stranger with these issues,
yes.
you need to talk to them in a way that they understand.
Yes.
So this is really hard.
Yes.
And, you know, taking this burden is not easy at all.
No, it's not easy. No.
So we should say that late Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali was really, you know, mukhlis and sincere in this
yes,
regard to
good.
Accept such invitation and have such devotion to Islam to, you know, take such a, you know,
yeah.
huge burden on his shoulder.
That's
to
right.
defend Islamic
yes.
ideologies.
I think what helped the late Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali very much in the U.S. was his mastery over different resources and references, you know. Because, you know, in the Western world, especially in the academic sense of the world, really they pay very much attention to the books and the references and the resources with which you are familiar. And this was, I think, the advantage of the presence of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali in that atmosphere over there. Mm-hmm. Because when you have mastery over different resources and the people get to you in order to find answers, you can introduce to them authentic resources and references. And this is, I think, very great.
Yes, you know, because nowadays we see that these scholars, or let me use the word that maybe scholars is somehow... is referring to a person who is in high level of knowledge.
Yes.
There are some, you know, individuals or students in yes. Islamic seminaries that they are invited by, you know, some Western
yes.
communities to be, you know, the resident alim or resident scholar of the place.
Yes.
But the problem is that because, you know, some people are not knowledgeable enough.
Mm-hmm.
So... And they are in a position that they are questioned by people
yes.
in many different fields.
Yes.
So this makes the situation hard to them.
Hard to them, that's right.
And that's why the figures like Ayatollah Jalali
yes.
was successful
yes.
in this field. Because,
that's
you know,
right.
whenever questions are coming toward him,
mm-hmm.
he knows from where this question is arose
that's right.
and how he should face with such question.
That's right.
But if I'm not a well-experienced person,
mm-hmm.
I'm not, you know... Well, I'm not having a good experience regarding a hadith or regarding the tafsir of
yes.
Ayatul Quran. So when questions comes toward me, so I need to, you know,
yes.
make some, you know, answers
yes.
from my own side. And
okay.
this make the situation difficult.
That's all right. Sheikh Mahdawi, that's why he established the open school over there, isn't it? I mean, the open school under the management of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Hussaini Jalali was established in Chicago, isn't it?
Yeah, this is, when we refer to his biography, we see one of his great achievement is establishment of the open school in the West. And we know that how it is difficult to get adopted with the society to the extent that you are not only invited there, you are given this chance to establish
That's all right.
Such a cultural entity among
mm-hmm.
them. And everybody is going to know that place with your name. And who is this person and what kind of personality is being carried by this person? It's a kind of traditional personality, being the student of Sayyid Abul Qasim al-Khoui, being
yes.
the student of Sayyid Muhsin al-Hakim, being born in Karbala.
Yes.
Yes. So
yes.
how we can imagine,
yeah.
nowadays it is possible because
yeah.
of the communication that we have nowadays with abroad, students are coming
yes.
to Qom, from Qom students are moving, whether or not they are native Iranian
yes.
or they are from other countries who
yes.
have come to Qom to learn about Islam and then move back to their country.
Yes.
It is possible
yes.
this day. But back to the time that Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali was living, it was kind of...
Yeah, it was difficult.
Yes,
man.
It was
yeah.
Yeah. hardly.
Yeah.
Let's say hardly we would imagine that
yes.
a person who had the experience of being student of
yeah.
Sayyid Abul Qasim al-Khoui,
yes.
living the environment of Iraq,
yes.
and living that traditional environment and migrating, as my brother mentioned, to U.S.,
And as you said, the establishment of the school.
The open
school.
Yes,
the establishment of a cultural entity, it shows how powerful he was in terms of his knowledge, in terms of his personality, his morality, and being commonly accepted by the people over there.
Again, the concept of tabliq comes to my mind, you know, how much this tabliq and, dissemination of the thoughts and propagation of the thoughts of the Shiite Muslims and Shiite theology is important, especially in today's world. Because, you know, sometimes the problem is this. We have so many non-Muslim scholars on Islam and the Shiite Islam who are compiling the books. Sometimes these books come to the Muslim lands, are translated, and are used by the public, okay? But the picture that is shown is not authentic at all. The case is that we have to, I think, nurture some scholars who have the capability and mastery over different resources and know different languages, and then send them to all across the world in order to preach the true Islam in the true sense of the word. Of course, Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali himself was a faqih, was a jurist, he was an Ayatollah, got ijazah from Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani. So for sure, establishing a school like the Open School in Chicago really helped very much the Shiite population over there. And there are some people who nowadays have some problems because of these, the sanctions that are done on some of the Muslim lands. So they can stay in their homelands and benefit from preachers like this person over there and the schools over there. I think this is really great. What he had done was really great. Very much sacrifice is needed. He has also some compilations, isn't it? I mean, there are some compilations. Of course, as they say, his scholar life is divided into three parts. Some of them are authoring the books, the other one on bibliography, and the other one are on the correction or editing of the books, because he was a codicologist too, and this is very important. That's all right. So this outstanding man, I mean Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Jalali, passed away on Rabi Yosani 5th, 1442, according to the Hijra calendar. It was about 1 year and a half years ago, or 1 year ago, that's right, in Chicago, in the U.S., and he was buried in the cemetery of the Muslims of Chicago over there. May Allah bless his soul, and may Allah bless the soul and protect the true preachers of Islam who are truly sacrificing their lives and dedicate their life to the path of Islam, the Shia Islam, and Imam of the age, Imam al-Mahdi al-Jalallah. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziaynia.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi for your presence in the program, The Teacher.
You're most welcome, madam.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was The Teacher on the life and works of Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Husseini Jalali, the founder of the Open School of Chicago. May Allah bless his soul. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.